Welcome to Subscriptions for Authors. Meet your co-hosts, Michael Evans, sci-fi thriller author of a dozen novels, and Amelia Rose, a semi-romance author that makes six figures per year in subscriptions. Together, we will help you make more money with subscriptions and succeed in the future of publishing.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of the Storytellers with the World show. It's me and Ariel again, and we're going to be talking about 10 TV shows fiction authors must watch. And let me tell you, TV is great to inspire us as authors. In fact, it really is one of, if not the most popular mode of storytelling, really, in our modern era. So there's a lot we can learn from it. But with that said, I don't really watch much TV slash really ever. Like, I can't remember the last TV show I watched. So this is going to be interesting because I feel like I'm going to learn something from you, Ariel, when you share with us 10 TV shows fiction authors must watch, because I am not a TV kind of person. So this will be very interesting. So with that said, let's just dive into it. 10 TV shows we must watch.
Let's get started. So I'm going to have a mix of not safe for work and safe for work recommendations here so that whichever you prefer to watch, you're
covered. I'll plug my ears during the not safe for work ones.
You do that. We'll protect your innocence.
Can't do that one.
We're gonna start off with not safe for work rec, which is Game of Thrones. Hear me out. I know the last two seasons, really the last three seasons, were awful. Okay, I know. But if you want a show that actually does a good job of portraying epic fantasy in a relatable, connectable, easy to digest way, watch Game of Thrones. There are, my partner and I are actually watching through Game of Thrones right now. It does what shows like Rings of Power and Wheel of Time and a lot of other fantasy shows that are coming out right now struggle really hard to do, which is make fantasy easily digestible, right? And it's really funny when you think about it, because Song of Ice and Fire, which is the book series behind Game of Thrones, is massive. Like, we're talking, those books are that thick. Okay, they're Les Miserables sized. But it doesn't take you nearly as long to read them as it does Les Miserables, somebody who's read those. I'm not through the first book of Game of Thrones, but I've gotten started on it. And what it does, the show also does, is you have this massively complex world, so many layers, so many characters. Like, you need a wiki to keep track of it all. I've read the Game of Thrones wiki maybe three times. There's two of them, and I've read both of them. But you never feel, some people do, but for the most part, when you get started, you don't feel like, oh no, there's so much going on, I can't keep track of it, I have to stop watching. And there's a lot of discourse about what made Game of Thrones so popular, and we've seen in the years since Game of Thrones ended, a lot of other shows trying to come along and do what Game of Thrones did, and all of them have failed so far. And it's because they do not understand, a little bit of personal opinion here, they do not understand what made Game of Thrones so popular. One of the major things that made Game of Thrones so popular is because anyone could come in and watch it. You didn't need to be a fantasy fan. You didn't need to know what high fantasy was or low fantasy or whatever. You didn't need to know what epic fantasy was. And technically, like, that's a conversation for a different day, exactly where high, epic, heroic, low, etc. Game of Thrones falls. But the style of storytelling is epic storytelling with lots and lots of layers, lots and lots of POVs, lots and lots of stories interconnecting and happening at the same time. And Game of Thrones does a very good job of just putting you in the world and revealing things as you go, instead of being like, here we are in chapter one, we must now discuss the backstory of this ancient house for five pages and bore you to death before we actually get into the story. In case you can't tell, I'm not a fan of that kind of storytelling. Full respect if you are. But there is a difference in when you start Game of Thrones season one, as the first episode, you actually learn about four of the major, or you meet people from at least four of the major seven houses. But aside from, I think, one reference to the Seven Kingdoms, you're not told, hey, there are seven major houses. Hey, you're meeting four of them. You learn that as you go through the season. You learn about the major houses. You learn about the major players. You're not immediately dropped in with people saying, okay, now we have to tell you about our world. So it is excellent for anyone who's writing an epic style story, particularly any kind of epic fantasy, high, low, urban, whatever. Court intrigue, political intrigue. It's one of the few court intrigue dramas that's labeled court intrigue that I actually find court intrigue in, because that's an easily misunderstood thing, what court intrigue really is.
What is court intrigue?
So Congress in the United States, picture that, but in a fantasy court. That's actual court intrigue. Like, we're talking stabbing, and we're talking corruption, and we're like, a lot of books that I've read that have said, this is court intrigue. So the heir is missing, and one person in court wants them back, and the other person does not. Yes, that's technically court intrigue, but it's really baby court intrigue, and I'm not putting it down. But if we're really court intrigue, be more to the court than three people. But that's not... Look at some history here. And Game of Thrones, Song of Ice and Fire was very inspired by the Wars of the Roses in England, which is a whole fascinating thing. But there are more people to the court, and America hasn't done court intrigue drama nearly as well as harem dramas from China and South Korea and occasionally Japan actually do, and Turkey, do court intrigue better than most American dramas. Rain got into that a little bit, but Game of Thrones is actually really good, where there are a lot of multiple perspectives and players in the court, and you have 15 different positions between the king's council and the king's hand. So it really gives you a scope for intrigue that isn't present in something like a Disney movie. Full respect to Disney or any fairy tales or fantasies that are a little more of that flavor, but it's not really super involved, complicated, epic style court intrigue.
Okay, so I'm with you. I'm interested now, but I know that we also have another story. This one, story number two, or show number two, is Shadow and Bone, which I'm curious about because, one, I have not watched it, but I know that the next season got canceled. And I also know that it's an adaptation of an extremely well-selling, famous fantasy series written by Leigh Bardugo. This is feels especially applicable to authors, but any thoughts on why it got canceled? Obviously, we don't know, but any thoughts?
Personal theories, Netflix and money. Netflix doesn't like to renew their shows more than two or three seasons because they have to pay their actors more. Because once you put out two to three seasons, actors get a chance to negotiate higher pay, especially if the show's doing well. And this is a consistent pattern across many of Netflix's shows where they don't want to pay their actors more. Can Netflix afford it? Of course they can. Like, Netflix is not exactly in a Hurt Locker here, okay? Anyway, yes. So Shadow and Bone is safe for work fantasy. It is based, like you said, on actually two series, make that three series, by Leigh Bardugo. It's based on the Grishaverse universe. So within that, there's the Alina Starkov trilogy, and the Shadow and Bone trilogy. And I can't remember if that's the official name of the trilogy. It's the first book. There's the Crows duology, Six of Crows and Crooked Kingdom. And then there's the Nikolai trilogy, I think. Duology? That might be a duology. Anyway, what they did in the TV show and did masterfully was combine all of these series into a cohesive storyline. And they did so well with it. Now, the Crows steal the show because the Crows always steal the show. It's actually a very good duology to read if you're looking for characterization tips, or if you like writing heist stories or love like Ragtag Band of Misfit / street urchins banding together into kind of a friendship group or found family of sorts. So it's a great duology to read if you love those things. But the TV show combined, wove that duology into the first trilogy, which is the foundational trilogy of the universe. And then in season two, they weave in Nikolai's story. And in the books, there is some interweaving of these stories, but it doesn't happen nearly as soon in the books as it does in the TV show. And it actually made, my personal opinion, the story much better, because the Alina Starkov trilogy is very formulaic YA. And if you like that, 100% go read it. I don't personally enjoy it. And there were a lot of tropes and stuff that were done in the Starkov trilogy that were not as maybe imaginatively executed as they could have been. They were formulaic. And the TV show actually improved that because the actors really enjoyed their roles and really leaned into them and made them their own. And the way it was interwoven with other stories really improved the quality of the story. It's very good for The Chosen One. There's some love triangle stuff in there. It's also a good example of the bad guy isn't the one that she should end up with because he's a bad guy. The only issue is that, unfortunately, the actor who was cast to play the villain had more chemistry with the lead actor than the other guy in the love triangle initially. So it does get a little bit off kilter there. But it does have a lot of really great chemistry of all kinds between characters because the cast really bonded and that really comes out in the role. So that's a safe for work. Rec, the second half of season two, the writing went off the rails. That said, it was not the second half of season two that killed that show. There's a lot that they could have come back from. There were a lot of people watching it. And it was one of the best fantasy shows on the air, so to speak. Especially exciting because it was based on a book series, a multiple book series. So yeah, Netflix is just, there weren't really a lot of reasons to cancel it.
This makes sense. Yeah, always multi-layered. Let's now move on to show number three, Cabinet of Curiosities. I'm going to challenge you for this show and each of our remaining shows to give one takeaway. Let's say I don't watch the show. What is one big lesson from that show for us as authors to improve our craft?
So Cabin of Curiosities is a horror anthology on Netflix. Yes, Netflix. It has, I believe, 8 episodes, and it was the brainchild of brilliant director Guillermo del Toro. Del Toro is my partner's favorite director, and we're like working our way through so much of his filmography. And Cabin of Curiosities, we saw when it aired, when it dropped. Like, we binged it over the next week. And, okay, I guess that's not a binge. But anyway, we saw it over the next week, and it is masterful horror writing. Each episode is about an hour long, I think, 45 minutes to an hour. And what's fascinating about this is that each episode is a different horror style. So you have the ghost story, you have body horror, you have the possession, classic possession horror type. So each of the, I'm pretty sure it's 8 episodes, each of them dealt with a different kind of horror that is common in horror writing. And as such, basically no matter what kind of horror you write, you can take a lot of things away from the series. It is brilliantly filmed. It is brilliantly written. And you feel, the thing about horror, I'm not a horror fan. My partner is. So I've watched a lot more horror in the last year and a half than in my entire life before that. But the thing about horror that always fascinates me is how the mundane becomes horrifying when you put a different lens on it. And Cabinet of Curiosities, I would say this is one big takeaway from pretty much every single one of those episodes, is things that are otherwise mundane, things that you wouldn't even look twice at, in the right setting, with the right tension, with you being frustrated or scared by something or nervous or apprehensive, all of a sudden things that were mundane become horrifying. And sometimes there's a reason for that. And sometimes it's just jumping at shadows, but you're jumping in every shadow. And so you don't know what's real and what's not past a certain point in the horror story. And Cabinet of Curiosities is just, it's literally a horror masterclass. If you want a masterclass in how to write horror, go watch Cabin of Curiosities. If you have a Netflix subscription, if you can find it, whatever. Seriously, because a Netflix subscription is cheaper than most masterclasses, and this is a masterclass in writing horror, all kinds of horror.
I love it. Cabin of Curiosities. Okay. Well, let's move on to show number 4, which is Leverage. Now, this show, I've never even heard of. I'd heard of all the other ones. never even heard of this one. And there's a few of these that you recommend that I've not heard of. And it seems like a thriller, and it seems very, very interesting. And why don't you tell us one takeaway that we have as authors from it, and maybe why we should watch it.
So Leverage is older in a sense of it hasn't been on air for many years. It was a cable show. I don't even remember what channel or network or anything, but it ran for 5 seasons, and the seasons were shorter, like 13 or 16 episodes a piece, like most cable shows back in that day. It's essentially a heist crew, but it's a Robin Hood story. And the whole premise is that these 5 people who are all criminals, for some reason, most of them, because they steal things, but they steal things in like different ways. You have the thief just steals things. You have the grifter who also steals things, but by grifting. And then you have the hacker who steals digital things, and he steals things by hacking. And you have the hitter, when he goes in to steal things, he just knocks everyone down. And then you have the mastermind. And it's these 5 characters who come together to fight against corruption and to help out the little people, right? Very Robin Hood. They lean into this even a few times. But the whole idea is the little people don't have anyone to help them. And in today's world, more so now than even at the time that this show came out, but then too, there isn't really anyone around to help the little people, because what they need that they don't have, so to speak, is leverage against the corporations, the corrupt lawyers, the millionaires and billionaires, the government at times, where the government did, or the military or something. Like, that's the story. And that's what this team does, is they provide that leverage. They go out, they find a case or a case is brought to them, and they help these people. And I would say there's so much that's brilliant about the show. When people ask me what my favorite show is, it's not Leverage. We're going to get to that one at the end. But Leverage is the one that I recommend as the best written TV show I have ever seen. And the biggest takeaway that I would say from Leverage, first of all, if you want team dynamics, watch Leverage. If you want character arcs that are amazing and slowly progress through 5 seasons, watch Leverage. If you want chemistry and seeing how different characters spark off each other and bounce off each other with their opinions, and no one's totally right or totally wrong, it's just, this is my opinion, this is your opinion, we come at things differently, we're going to have friction, but we can also find a way to work together, watch Leverage. Like, it is amazing. It's on various streaming services right now. You can buy DVDs for anyone who still does those. I think you can get the digital downloads as well, season. But the biggest takeaway that I would say Leverage has is character arc are the most compelling thing that can keep people watching through episodic stories, through other kinds of stories. You can have a compelling character arc through an episodic story. And side note, there is a sequel to Leverage. It's called Leverage Redemption. And it does not, I don't personally recommend it to many people, because the character arcs in Leverage were so well done that at the end of the story, you'd had this amazing journey that each of the 5 main characters have gone on. Just incredible. Leverage Redemption starts, and at first, it starts in a really good place of, hey, let's revisit these characters. But unfortunately, the biggest issue I would say Leverage Redemption had, and spoilers ahead, is that it destroyed the best thing about Leverage, which was those character arcs. You went on this amazing journey with these 5 main characters in Leverage, and at the end, they'd completed this incredible arc, and Leverage Redemption went, we don't really know what to do with these characters afterwards, which, by the way, you can fix that with good writing. You can go back years after and have an actually satisfying show. Leverage Redemption just didn't do this. And so they regressed a lot of characters in a way that didn't make sense. You can regress a character in a way that makes sense. These ways don't make sense. So that's Leverage. But the biggest takeaway is character arcs for amazing, incredible character arc that are the wonderfully layered journey showing not just how they improve as people when they get put into situations that challenge them, but how as people they interact with each other and challenge each other and grow each other.
An amazing cast of characters. Like, I'm all in on it, and it's awesome. And show number five here is very famous, which is The Mandalorian. Why don't you tell us about why we should watch that show?
Okay, so first of all, base dad adopts tiny alien baby begrudgingly, but they become the dearest thing in the galaxy to each other, and they go on adventures together. If you're looking for a feel-good show, watch The Mandalorian. But specifically, The Mandalorian is an excellent example. How many seasons are out now? Two, three seasons? I can't remember how many seasons are out, but The Mandalorian is an excellent example of how you can tell a series of stories, and it doesn't matter if you are telling this series as multiple books or as a serial, but you can take just one character or two characters, really, and the simplest of arcs, and it can be one of the most compelling things that you've seen because it's emotionally so investing. From the moment that we know, spoilers ahead, that this guy has been hired to kill this freaking adorable alien baby. And he looks at it and he goes, I can't do this. You know there's going to be a world of conflict ahead because he was hired for a job. He didn't do a job. There's a child involved. That trips so many emotional triggers for just everyone. And here's this gruff bounty hunter, alien warrior, who is from a culture that was destroyed. It is jam-packed with tropes to just make you go, oh, ow, rude. But it doesn't feel like a complicated story. You go into it, you start watching, and it doesn't feel complicated. It feels very simple. He's just a dad trying to protect his kid. And through the story, like all of these extra layers that happen through the adventures themselves are very simple in format. Again, incredibly, not basic, but simplistic plots and plot lines, yet incredibly compelling because of the emotional interplay of the characters. And further note, you do not have to know anything about the Star Wars universe to watch The Mandalorian. You can jump right in. There are extra layers of things that you won't know if you haven't seen other Star Wars stuff. But there were a couple shows that I hadn't even seen, a couple of the animated things that I hadn't seen that was brought in one season or something like that. And I didn't miss anything. So you don't have to know the Star Wars universe to watch The Mandalorian. And if you watch only one Star Wars thing in your life, make it The Mandalorian. Because the biggest takeaway from that is that you do not need massively complex plots and storylines to tell not just a good and emotionally compelling story, but a good emotionally compelling theory.
I love it. I love it. No, that's a high compliment. If there's one show to watch in the whole Star Wars universe, one thing to watch The Mandalorian. Okay. For show number six, this one's very new. And I also didn't know it existed, but I maybe this is new, so I won't get too mad at myself here. Renegade Nell seems absolutely like a fascinating story. As we've been going, what's one craft thing and what's one other thing to learn about? And also, let me just say that we have a bonus show coming in. I know we said only 10 shows, but there's an 11th show that you're going to really want to hear about. So you should stay tuned until the end just to hear that 11th show. But show number six, Renegade Nell. What can we learn from it? Why should we watch it?
So I'm going to back up for just a second because I forgot to tag the last three shows with safe for work or not safe for work. So Cabinet of Curiosities, I would say, is not safe for work because of the horror themes. There's content warnings you can find online, but that's not safe for work. Leverage and The Mandalorian are safe for work. Renegade Nell, so far, is also safe for work and probably always will be because it's on Disney Plus and is a show. Young adult show about who's Kate? Even, oh no, it's during the reign of Queen Anne in England. And it's essentially a historical superhero show, a genre bending show in the sense of it actually does fall into like historical fantasy or superhero. You can classify it either way. And it's a fascinating discussion just to have about that and genre and what's genre bending and what's not, and what the true genre cross, and what, that's not why we're here today. It's, again, of a very simple story at its core. It's a girl who sets out to protect her family and gets caught up in protecting the throne. So very simple, like, plot formula, very recognizable as well. You've seen that in a lot of YA stories. So very tried and true in a lot of ways. But what's fascinating about it is that a lot of times when you watch a historical show, it feels historical. They're basically shoving in your face that this is historical, this doesn't exist anymore. And that's fine for some shows. Bonnet dramas, period dramas do really well with that. This, you do not go into it and immediately go, oh, so we're in historical times. You get that impression, yes, but it's not front and center. The historical setting is not the star of this show. The story is the star of the show. It just happens to take place in a historical setting with fantasy elements. It's one of the best historical fantasy things I've ever seen. And it's really good at, I've talked a little bit before, probably in the Theory Lab, but I should make a video on this for YouTube as well, about how with ensemble casts, you have two ways of doing it. You have everybody's basically equals. You have five people leverage. Leverage the true ensemble cast, is one form of an ensemble cast where, like, all of the characters receive equal attention. Renegade Nell is closer to the different kind. Like, The Mandalorian's not an ensemble cast, and Renegade Nell is the cross between this and the second kind of ensemble cast, or between The Mandalorian and the second kind of an ensemble cast, where you have one character who's main, and then you have several secondary characters, and then you have minor characters. And Renegade Nell is that kind of a story. And it's just a really good example of how to write historical in a way that does not feel like it's more historical or more fantasy. I would say the biggest craft lesson from Renegade Nell is blending genres to where it feels natural. Like, it truly feels like a unique setting, a setting of its own, where you're not forcing the combination of genres. I've seen a lot of genre subgenres or genre crosses where they feel forced. It's, I want to write a historical fiction, but I need these fantasy elements, and the fantasy elements feel like an afterthought. Or I'm writing fantasy, but it's historically inspired, but I'm not really doing much of the historical elements in them. And Renegade Nell really combines those in not even what I would say is a new or fresh way, but in just an actually good way. Caveat, I have not seen the end of this series. We're somewhere in the middle. So I can't say, like, how the execution continues through the story, but so far it's very good.
You have another new show, show number 7, which is Dead Boy Detectives, which this one seems a little wild, but actually totally up my alley. Like, teenage ghosts, a little drama in there. I'm here for it. Is this a show that you'd recommend to, like, all writers? Or is there, like, hey, if you write X, you really, like, out of all these 10 shows, you should start here. I'm curious about that, in addition to, like, sharing what lessons we can learn and why we should watch it. The who should watch it.
So Dead Boy Detectives is new, like Michael said, on Netflix. It's in the Sandman universe by Neil Gaiman. It's so good. It is a safe for work YA story where we have, I think they're like 19, but two ghosts who are detectives, and they have a paranormal mystery agency, like private investigator agency. And if you write teen horror, if you write urban fantasy of any shape, like adult, teen, whatever, and if you write, honestly, I would recommend it to anyone who writes YA queer fiction as well as YA episodic fiction of any kind. because, and little gang of friends, because it's very good at all of those things. But definitely if you write ghost horror or if you write urban fantasy of any shape, watch this. And it is, again, a little bit of a genre blend because the ghosts are from different time periods. They're in the modern age. It's very paranormal. It's very urban fantasy. But it's also got elements of horror. In like the case they take an urban fantasy and horror frequently crossover. And this one was done very well. And it also was really good at chemistry and relationships. And we're running from this big thing. People who've seen Good Omens, people who've seen The Sandman, will recognize some common themes between the shows because they're all Neil Gaiman. But I did a whole serial lab on Dead Boy Detectives because it has one of the best, just put you into the story and reveal things about the world as you go and introduce you to the characters and make you care about the characters before hitting you with a lot of world building that I've ever seen. So my main takeaway from Dead Boy Detectives is whether you start your story with like action or a different kind of moment, get us to care about the characters by putting the characters in some kind of peril or having them be surprised or having some big emotion that you can connect with immediately and care about these two main characters before we reveal like why they're even here. Because you leap right into this story with these two characters in danger. And the first question is not, who are these people? The first question is, how are they going to get out of this? And it's one of the best openings that I've seen in stories in a long time.
As we know, openers are extremely important. You can nail a good opener. You can hook someone for the rest, even if the rest of your story is, it has to be good. But if you can have an excellent opener and then a good story, you will probably sell great. Whereas having a mediocre beginning, good story, great ending might leave fans really happy and wanting your next book, but a lot of fans won't even get to the end. Now, your next show, show number 8 now, is Bridgerton, which obviously I do know this show. And also, I'm almost confident it's not safe for work. So do I have to hold my ears for this one? Or
you do. You need to hold your ears for this one. It's very not safe for work.
Very not safe for work. And that explains why so many of my female college age friends are very into it. Oh, no.
Yep. Yeah, anyone who's been in the Serial Lab or the Serial Facebook group or knows that I have a long history with Bridgerton, which I will do videos and videos on. You're going to get theories of videos on Bridgerton. But essentially, Bridgerton is a fantasy romance show set in a pseudo-historical Regency period in England. So think Jane Austen, but fantasy and also no historical accuracy. Pretty much. So little historical accuracy as to be negligible. But Bridgerton is also based on a book series. There was a Regency romance book series by Julia Quinn that was published, I think it started in like 2003 or 2001. I can't remember which one. But it's from the early 2000s, this book series. And it followed a format that was popular in romance book series at the time and still is, which is have a family of siblings, and then you follow the romances of each sibling as they grow up and they find their happily ever after. And it's very popular among romance readers, especially then, but even now, because having a family allows for an interconnectedness among characters and among couple that you don't find as much when you're writing just like, I'm writing 5 novels in this series about girls in this small town. It's a little bit different. Like you come at things a little bit differently from this is a family of siblings who are all finding their romances versus this is a group of friends who are all finding their romances, or this is a group of people who are connected by this other theme. And there's obviously advice is different for each way of doing things, but the family of siblings all finding their romances was very popular at the time and still is, because to a certain degree, you can get to know the characters for all of the other couples without needing to feature them in a very prominent secondary place. Like they can kind of run in the background. Like couples 3 through 8 can run in the background of couples 1, couples 2, and then just move up the stairs of being involved in the story in more prominent roles as their romance has come up. So it's like moving them from the back burner to the side burner to the front burner, right? And it allows for doing that in a different and some feel a more natural way when it's a family of siblings. Like there are ways to make it natural no matter what you're writing. But it does allow for a different way of doing that when it's a family of siblings. And that's Bridgerton. And Shonda Rhimes picked up the first book at some point. I think it was during COVID. And she's, hey, I want to make a TV series out of this. Netflix, let's make this happen. It's Shonda Rhimes who's going to say no. So Netflix made it happen. Julia Quinn made it happen. And this is a very, very not safe for work show. And also, if you tried season 1, it's actually the weakest of the 3 seasons. Season 3 is split into 2 parts. First part's out. Second part's coming out in like a week or something like that. I haven't even finished season 3 yet. But the thing that Bridgerton does, the show, first of all, it does a lot of things better than the books because it really connects characters better. And so you feel like you are in this world of interconnected characters because you've seen these from season 1 and now in season 3, they're in a more prominent role. And you really get to feel like you're in this world with them and that you know the same people in society that they do. But we've talked a lot before about how cliffhangers and drama in romantic serials can really connect people and keep them coming back because they want to know what happens. And it's that suspense. And Bridgerton does that very well. And it also, I would actually say the biggest takeaway from Bridgerton craft-wise, besides a couple of things of what not to do, season 1, calling you out. We all know the scene I'm talking about. Except for maybe Michael, you keep your ears covered. Definitely not a scene.
I was the one who thought Reem was just paper.
Lesson number 1 from that scene, not everything that's in the books should have been reproduced on screen. That said, I would say the biggest takeaway from Bridgerton is actually how they interweave the couples so that when it's time for the next couple to take the stage, the viewer is ready for that and they want that and they are shipping that. Again, not safe for work. Read your content warning. Put your filters on, whatever you need to.
Lovely. Okay. No, I might have to join the dark side and jump into Bridgerton now. Yeah. No, this is the exciting. And now for show number 9, which I had also, this is like show number 4 on this list that I've never heard of because I never heard of Leverage, Renegade Nell, Deadwood Vectors. I've also never heard of Moon Knight, but I'm a little confused about this show. I'm going to be honest. I haven't watched it, obviously, but I'm confused. Like, it's Marvel? Is it a Marvel show? Okay. So it's a Marvel show and it only ran for 1 season. Okay. Dive into what, why, and who.
So Moon Knight, it is a Marvel show for, I'm going to say, a less well-known character. And I'm going to have 15 of the nerds that we're so fortunate to have in Storytellers Rule the World groups go, I don't know who that is. I know, I'm pretty sure I know of at least 2 nerds in the Academy who are absolutely going to know the show right off. But it is a Marvel show. It's about a lesser known character with dissociative identity disorder. And he's a superhero, but he has multiple identities. And the show is, again, I think 8 episodes. So it's a typical streaming show length. And it's masterful. I have never seen a show so beautifully combine superhero with mythology with modern day as Moon Knight, with one of the most intense and incredible emotional journeys of the main character, because he has multiple identities. So the main characters are all played by the same actor who, personal opinion, one of the best actors of our time ever, like Oscar Isaac, nailed these roles. It's incredible. It's emotionally engaging. It's emotionally gutting. It's insane. And I don't know the reason it was canceled after 1 season. I don't know the reason they're not bringing out a 2nd season after brilliantly setting it up, other than the fact that Disney really doesn't know what it's doing, which we all know. But seriously, I would say the biggest takeaway from Moon Knight for craft is if you want to see story. So who should watch it and why first? And then we'll get into craft, which is if you love mythology, particularly Egyptian mythology, which I do, If you like superhero stories, if you like a show that really tried to be respectful of the cultures that it was incorporating, and a show that made superheroes feel less superhero and more human, but did a really good job of portraying the superhero sides too. And if you like writing what trauma does to people, and you can argue all day whether dissociative identity disorder is real or not. Like, I am not here for that psychological discussion right now. But storytelling-wise, it made for a very fascinating, compelling story of what one person did to cope with trauma. So I would say the biggest craft takeaway from Midnight is that you don't have to lean into the cliches even when you're writing tropes, because as a superhero story, Midnight is full of tropes. A lot of superhero stories are. But it didn't lean into the cliche version of those. And that's, for the few people that I know who really love Midnight, the comics, that's one reason that they love it. It's become different. It doesn't feel like your 1-800 dial a superhero. And again, some of the best acting I have ever seen.
Dang. Okay. All right. That's high, high praise.
It is also on Disney Plus, and it is safe for work. Dang.
That was like a very in between safe for work. I'm kidding around. But that's
pretty cool. I'm pretty sure it's safe for work. I don't recall any not safe for work scenes, but also I haven't seen it again since it came out. A rewatch is due, but.
Like, it's safe for teenagers, but maybe not safe for our elementary school kids and below. But now we have our last show, except the bonus show, Wreck, is coming. So wait for that. We're almost there. If you've been eagerly on the edge of your seat, could not anticipate what this 11th bonus show will be, then you're almost going to have it revealed to you. But for our 10th show, this show I do know, and I've heard great things about. But to be clear, I've watched absolutely none of these shows. So there's not a single show here that I've even watched an episode of, even including Game of Thrones. Game of Thrones, I played the Telltale video game, which only was like, I think maybe one or two seasons long, but I loved it. But Love, Death, and Robots. Now this one I've heard amazing things about, truly amazing things. But what is your review?
So this is actually probably the most recent show for me on this list is this one, or maybe Renegade Now. But either way, it's one of the more recent shows that I've seen, and my partner introduced me to it. And first thing to know is it has a mix of safe for work and not safe for work episodes. So I would just make sure that you do your homework before you watch it anywhere. Love, Death, and Robots is three seasons of a bunch of animation studios, each coming together and doing a different episode of a robot story. And it spans so many genres. There is something for almost everyone in this show, no matter what genre you like, no matter what kind of story you write. And the episodes are short, so they range from 5 to 20 or 25 minutes. I don't think there are any that go over 25 minutes. So it doesn't take like a huge time commitment, and you can watch the shorter ones when you have a short amount of time and the longer ones when you have 20 minutes. You can binge all of it in 4 hours, something like that. But there are so many genres of story across these three seasons that are all connected by just one element. There's a robot, some way, somehow. And for writing short stories, it is one of the best examples I have ever seen in how to tell a compact story without making the audience feel like they need more. They might want more, but there's a really big difference. And this is a difficult balance to strike with short stories sometimes, where you want the audience to feel satisfied with the story. They need to feel like it was a complete story. They need a complete story for a short story, but they might want more, they just don't need more. And that's a tricky balance to walk with short stories, but Love, Death, and Robots does it brilliantly. And that is the craft lesson, I would say, to take away from it. If you write short stories, watch Love, Death, and Robots. If you like robots, if you like sci-fi, urban fantasy, mythological fantasy, cyberpunk, a lot of cyberpunk, if you like soldier stories, if you like romances, if you like greedy conquistadores getting their just dessert, watch Love, Death, and Robot. There's a massively wide variety of stories in this, and it's incredible.
I No, I'm excited. I think my honest biggest takeaway from this is to go to my local library, load up my Netflix subscription, and watch all these shows in public. No, but no, but seriously, this sounds like an amazing show. I'm excited for Love, Death, and Robots. I think that's probably the top one of my list because I really like Black Mirror. That's always one of my favorite shows, and it's basically a series of short stories-ish, but they're a bit longer. But regardless, like it's episodic in the way that you don't need to read it in a serialized format, but can just go in, get out, go in, get out. So I love Black Mirror, and this sounds a lot like you can just take something, leave, come back. But there's a lot of good stuff there. So no, that's amazing. Now, our bonus show, I do know this show. I'm feeling a lot of people have already watched the show, but certainly not everyone. And it feels very fitting, given that we're in election year. So why don't you reveal what the bonus show is and why and who should watch it?
Absolutely, but I'm going to leave everyone on a cliffhanger for just a few seconds longer while I go back and make sure that I've let you all know where you can see the previous show. But you're going to have to hold on a little bit longer. Game of Thrones was an HBO show, so if you have HBO Plus or any other service that like includes HBO, that's where you'll find it. Shadow and Bone was Netflix. Cabinet of Curiosities was Netflix. Leverage can be found on a bunch of different streaming platforms, and I believe it's on Freevee if you have Prime or something like that, as well as I can't remember what, but there was, I think, a free with ad streaming service that Leverage and a lot of Dean Devlin's shows are on, and Devlin did Leverage. Mandalorian and Renegade Nell are both Disney Plus. Dead Boy Detectives and Bridgerton are Netflix. Moon Knight is Disney Plus, Love, Death, and Robots is Netflix, and the bonus show, again, you can find on a bunch of different platforms. I think Netflix has it. I think Hulu might have it. But our bonus show is, I mentioned earlier in the video, when people ask me what my favorite show is, the answer is different from what do I consider the best written TV show of all time, because I consider Leverage so far to be the best written TV show of all time. But my favorite show is The West Wing. Now, this is probably the oldest of the shows on our list because the first season of The West Wing aired in 1999, and I was just a child, and Michael wasn't even born yet. So it's an old show. And it ran for 7 seasons. Notably, the first four were helmed by Aaron Sorkin, the creator of the show. And the last three, which are not my favorite, they're not written as well, were helmed by someone else. But sorry, amazing. So The West Wing is a political drama. And if you write political dramas, if you write political intrigue, if you write thrillers with political elements, if you write anything with political intrigue or court intrigue elements, The West Wing, incredible. One of my friends who also loves The West Wing says The West Wing is the show that always makes you want to be patriotic, and then you look around at our current system and oh no. It's very, it feels more idealistic now than it did in 1999. And one of the most fascinating things about this show is that it started before 9/11. So I was a preteen when 9/11 happened, vividly remember it. And this is one of the shows that actually spans that time period. And subtly, other than one episode where it's front and center, really demonstrates the changes that went on in America politically and socially after 9/11. So that's like this subtle show don't tell sideline that you don't even think about unless you're watching it afterwards. When I showed it to my sister for the first time, now my sister's young enough that she doesn't remember 9/11. And I showed it to my sister for the first time, and there's an episode in the first season, so pre-9/11, where something happened. And my sister goes, "That is the most unrealistic thing I've ever seen. I thought you said this show was good." And I said, "What are you talking about?" And she said, "They don't do that nowadays." And I said, "Oh, you don't re- Oh, well, they did before 9/11." And it was this very impactful moment for me personally because it was the first time I had come face to face with the stark cultural shift that took place that I lived before and after. So that's fascinating. I know, but The West Wing is about the senior staff of a fictional president in the White House. And it's literally, it's not slice of life, but it's a political drama in the sense of all of the stories are about the issues facing the nation, facing lawmaking, but also the core of the story is not like House of Cards, is more about who can climb their way to the top and then stay there with the House of Cards. The West Wing is more about how can we as people, what motivates us as people to be in these positions, to be affecting change, to be helping the other people of the nation? Why are we here and what are we doing with that? And it's great looks at like the realities at the time of trading in political intrigue and political drama, right? Where it's, here's the desired end, but in order to get there, we have to do this and this and this, and we have to make this deal here in order to make this deal here, in order to make this deal here, which is what we need to achieve this. So seriously, if you write political drama of any kind or political intrigue or court intrigue, watch The West Wing, because the biggest craft takeaway is that at the end of the day, the thing that makes you invested and interested in this story is not the politics, it's the people. The people are the heart of the story, and the people are the heart of any political intrigue, political drama, court intrigue. The people are at the heart of that. That's my biggest takeaway from The West Wing. And I will add the caveat that, again, the last three seasons, not as good as the first four, but it is an incredible show when you're looking at really showing a complicated political system or court system or any kind of really complex system where a lot of different moving parts do or don't work together, whether they should or shouldn't, in order to hopefully achieve certain ends. And genuinely, it, again, I know I've said it three times, but if you write intrigue of any kind at a governmental level, at a court level, watch The West Wing, because Aaron Sorkin is very good at, although he tends to reuse a lot of cliche and dialogues, he's very good at putting you in connection with the heart of the characters who at the end of the day are here because they wanted to serve.
I think that that is part of what we've lost in the world broadly over the last couple decades, as we've had this like soulless, like ultra capitalist, ultra technological, like frontier. We've like lost each other and lost like the meaning of why behind we do things. And I think it's important to return to that in our writing. And that's everything we try and do at Ream, is like with our values and our mission first. And yeah, it's like what makes life matter. So it's actually, I don't know, that's actually like hopeful, even though obviously there's a lot of drama and challenges in it, in the show, The West Wing. That seems really great. And this is really fun, Ariel. If y'all like this like different type of style of an episode, a little bit more conversational, a little bit more, most importantly, going through other things, not related to books, but related to TV shows, maybe video games next. We could do movies. We could do, honestly, like, animations and anime specifically. There's a lot of different things that we could get into and try and pull in episodes like this, and even dive deeper into TV shows and like lessons we can learn from it. As a call to action, we have an amazing episode with the screenwriter and author slash novelist Bart Barker. We'll make sure to link to it in the description here. It's a fireside chat slash webinar we did with him that was just like, it was top notch. Bart is an amazing guy, talking all about how to write great cliffhangers, and even more than that, just how to approach this industry and this world as writers and what we can learn from screenwriting. If you haven't checked that out, I definitely would. We'll link down to it below. And if you want more from Ariel, Ariel's, you can find her not only on the YouTube channel, not only in this RSS feed if you're listening to the podcast, but also the Serial Fiction for Authors Facebook group, and also the Serial Lab, which we're going to be opening up again in a couple months here. And you can find the actual waitlist down below in the description if you want to join and try and get your serial to a million reads and beyond. But with that said, Ariel, thank you so much for being here with us.
Thank you. It's fantastic.
I hope everyone has an amazing rest of their day. And don't forget, storytellers rule the world.